Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culloden and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, is it time you took a life admin day to sort out your personal economics? Is Austria providing a masterclass in infrastructure for the rest of Europe to follow? Plus, as EU and US relations falter, we ask if the Italian Prime Minister is the one to solve it. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Culloden. Now, like much of the world, I have been watching developments, the ever-changing developments in Davos very closely. And for my explainer this week, I wanted to start off by explaining what Davos is and how it could be arriving to these very shores. So close to 3,000 participants from 130 countries go to the World Economic Forum in Davos to get away from it all and have high-level discussions, literally, on the height of the slopes around all sorts of important world matters. Now, on top of that, you have an array of entourages and there's tens of thousands of people go to Davos at the same time. Now, you could have 65 heads of state, nearly 850 of the world's top CEOs and chairpersons. It is the place to be. But this week, though, it wasn't just Donald Trump that was causing a stir. Larry Fink, who's the co-chair of the World Economic Forum, he said in a letter that was first on the FT, Financial Times, said that the World Economic Forum should start doing something new, showing up and listening in the places where the modern world is actually built. Davos, yes, he says, but also places like Detroit and Dublin and cities like Jakarta and Buenos Aires. So maybe Taking Stock could be recorded live from the forum here in Dublin next year. In a continent often constrained by budgets and polarised politics, Austria is making huge strides in their transport infrastructure. Now, three new rail tunnels, eventually connecting Poland's Baltic coast to the Adriatic Sea, are set to transform rural Austrian villages into commuter towns, boosting both the housing and the job market. Now, should we follow suit then with Austria's infrastructure development? Jonathan Tyrone, reporter at Bloomberg, is with us now. Jonathan, if we first look at what the Corlum Bahn is, it's a 5.9 billion euro project that will reduce travel time between the country's second and fifth biggest cities from 3 hours to 45 minutes. It's the sixth, has the sixth largest railway tunnel in the world. It has catalysed more than 260 million of new track and 23 train stations have been built as part of the scheme. So tell us about the impact of this for Austria.
Well, people call this the biggest socioeconomic experiment in 150 years. I mean, it's transforming the daily lives of people who live along the route. It's stemming deindustrialization. It's reducing commuting times and increasing property prices. You know, this is a project that's been in the works for decades. And so the scale of it is really just hitting people. It's an experiment. People don't know if it's going to work as planned, but that's part of the risk of infrastructure. You know, thinking big in terms of infrastructure, you take a leap and you get a lot of benefits along the journey. And hopefully it's going to work out and reinvigorate some of the economic activity for the people who live in this part of Austria.
But Jonathan, I've looked at various different infrastructure projects either here in Ireland or around the world. I've never heard them being called a socioeconomic experiment. Usually they're there because we know that if you create stronger connectivity between different parts of the country, or in this case, across the European continent, it generally works. So why is this an experiment?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, most of Austria's trade moves east to west. We get most of our stuff that we import from Rotterdam. And so if you were looking at, you know, today's trading patterns and where the wealth is flowing, you'd be increasing the capacity of rail on an east to west direct. And in fact, some economists said, you know, Austria would have been better off spending all this money increasing capacity, you know, toward the North Atlantic. But Austria, you know, has a different calculation. It's not measured strictly in trade numbers today. It's also measured in, you know, the livelihoods of your populace, the people who live here, as well as calculations about, you know, how the world is going to develop in 40, 50, 100 years into the future.
And what sorts of calculations, like, do you, when you talk about the livelihoods, do you mean salaries people earn, or is it the value of their houses? What sort of metrics?
The kinds of industries that we're attracting. Along this corridor, there's a microelectronics industry, one of the few in Europe. They're building microchips.
Historically speaking, when Austria was at its richest, its trade flows went north to south. And so they were sending timber down, for example, in the 19th century to the Suez Canal, and then re-importing into Austria the equipment that dug out the Suez Canal to, you know, make some major infrastructure projects like the Danube Canal in Vienna with that equipment that came from Egypt. So, I mean, the idea between with these infrastructure projects where the payback time scale is measured in, you know, decades or centuries, I don't think that you can have the conceit that your business calculations based today, you know, your net present value calculation is going to be right. Human beings are notoriously poor when projecting long-term forecasts.
Okay, but Jonathan, can I just ask you on that net present value idea? Because if this costs 5.9 billion euro, in many other countries, that would be the cost, and therefore the return would be compared against that. But Austria manages this differently, don't you? You instead look at the operational cost of this every year. So instead of fighting for a big budget, the methodology of financing projects like this is done differently to other countries.
Yeah, that's correct. So, I mean, I was talking with some people in the National Railway, the infrastructure part. And I mean, basically, they work on 6-year budgets, right? So they're going to go to the national government. The national government is going to take out a loan, because this is all part of the Maastricht Treaty, right? It all counts against the Austrian debt per EU standards. But rather than doing it on a 1-year timeline, they're going and they're negotiating a 6-year budget. And they're taking that money and they're putting it toward the various infrastructure plans they have in the works. And what's interesting is that you know, these are some of the few people who actually have like a 40 to 50 year planning schedule. So the Austrian Rail Infrastructure Department is actually, you know, planning 40 to 50 years into the future. They're talking to me about, you know, wanting to cut the travel time from Vienna to Munich from 4 hours today to 2 hours by 2040. So, I mean, these are people with a long-term vision about where they want the country to go. And this is one of the reasons that infrastructure projects, it's one of the few areas where all parties agree. I mean, from the nationalist populist right wingers to the social democrats on the left side, I mean, everybody's on board with infrastructure because, you know, in addition to making people's life easier, voters' lives less costly by providing services that improve their standard of living, obviously, there's a lot of internal business, internal economic activity generated by these projects.
Yes, there is, in terms of building them. But then, of course, the real longevity of this is going to be the impact afterwards. And I'm wondering, like you mentioned there, the time taken to travel the distance between Vienna and Munich in half by 2040. How does infrastructure projects like this reorientate the entire economic map of the country, whether it is, as you say, between trade flows, or even where there now might be a commuter belt for a city that didn't exist before, made possible by this infrastructure?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let me draw that back in from, you know, something being planned for the future to something that's in operation today. You know, Vienna is surrounded by a province called Lower Austria. Lower Austria's capital is a place called St. Pölten. St. Pölten is about 40 kilometers away. And they reduced that commute to about 20 minutes. So essentially, they connected a high-speed rail between the capital of the surrounding province to Vienna so that people can, you know, step onto the commuter train like people who live in Vienna step onto their subway. And that has enabled the connection between two provincial capitals. I mean, Vienna is, in addition to this capital of the country, it's a province of its own. So, you know, this idea of connecting provincial capitals, connecting urban areas to create these agglomerations has been part of Austria's, I guess, you know, domestic development strategy for a long time.
In the Draghi report regarding EU competitiveness, Ireland was identified as having the slowest approval process in the EU. What are you doing in Austria that makes you different?
Well, I mean, I go back to the point that this is just politically popular. I mean, all parties support infrastructure. And, you know, there's definitely battles over eminent domain. Curiously, that's been more difficult to put up things like direct current high capacity power lines. I'm not trying to be evasive, but, you know, Austria basically delivers a service for its 9 million citizens that is very tangible. So you can get a 1,200 euro all-you-can-eat nationwide rail pass, right? So you're on all the rails that you want as often as you want to wherever you want to go. It's connected with buses. In the city of Vienna, you know, it costs a little bit over 1 euro for all you can eat subway rides and bus rides. You know, so the idea of making transportation, public transportation, cheap and of high quality has been kind of a strategy among all political parties that is supported widely among the population.
And yet, though, the cost of this hasn't been cheap. I looked at Fitch's latest credit rating analysis and they said Austria's debt ratio is nearly twice that of AA rated sovereigns. These projects come with a lot of cost, and therefore is there a lot of financial risk for the entire country as a result?
Well, I mean, I think Austria's debt to GDP ratio is still around 80%, which I think is probably right around the EU average. You know, it's a couple grades beneath, you know, AAA right now. The idea of, you know, infrastructure being the reason that Austria has experienced budget pressure, I would say, is not accurate. I'd look at things like the, you know, recovery from the pandemic still, the need to provide energy subsidies in the wake of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the subsequent cut off of Russian gas has bigger reasons that there's been economic difficulties in Austria.
And so one last question, Jonathan. What can countries like Ireland learn from Austria when it comes to building infrastructure?
That even if you build the infrastructure incorrectly, even if it's like a suboptimal infrastructure, that like it's still going to be something that's there and serves your people for potentially centuries, and that there's a higher cost in waiting and not building infrastructure than in building it and not getting it perfectly right. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good when it comes to infrastructure. Build it.
So just get it done. Well, thank you very much indeed for joining us from Vienna. Jonathan Tyrone, reporter at Bloomberg.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, how much money could you save by taking a life admin day? Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now for my trivia this week. I was in the place in the past few days which is widely accepted as the largest harbour in the world after Sydney. Where was I? Have a think, and I will give you the answer at the end of the show. Well, it's January. You might say, well, that's breaking news, Susan. But it might still be a while away yet until your first paycheck of the year. But what if I told you there are some easy steps you can take to save you hundreds or even thousands of euro in one day? Well, today we are talking to Michael Houghton, host of the Irish Fire podcast, about an idea called a Life Admin Day. So first up, Michael, will you share with us what is this concept that you've come up with?
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, it's really, really simple. We're all busy in our everyday lives, and it can be hard to remember to do all these things like switching our utility providers and checking our internet connection when it's due for renewal and so on. And so the idea is we give ourselves one day a year, we sit down and we do all of these things. So we check our insurance policies, we check our broadband, our Netflix, our Sky, all of those sort of things, and we make sure that we're getting the best deals that we can get or find on the day.
And what do you think holds us back from doing this at all? Like, do we really need to take a day? It probably takes 10 minutes to do any one of those things.
Do you know what? I think as humans, we don't always see the impact of small changes in our finances. And in truth, if we make lots of these small changes over time, then they do start to compound and you start to see the differences. But if you're maybe paying 10 or 20 euros more a month than you should be on your internet bill, is it worth the time to call up and do all of that when it's only going to save me 20 euros a month? But actually, it's saving you a lot more than that. It's saving you 240 euros a year. And over 10 years, it's saving you nearly 2,500 euro. So when you start to look at the bigger picture of these smaller changes, you start to realize that by taking one day a year out, that's a good opportunity for you to actually save a significant amount of money, which then compounds over time.
Well, when I heard about this idea, it reminded me of something that I read in Cal Newport's book called Deep Work, where he talks about making big gestures like this, taking, whether it's a day, being a Saturday, or taking a day of annual leave, to really going and committing to this. It might be the impetus you need to really make these things happen. But one thing you say, Michael, about living and obviously paying money for things in Ireland is that loyalty is penalised.
It is. And me being from New Zealand, I found this quite shocking when I first moved here 15 years ago. But loyalty is, right? Like, I often find when I get my insurance renewal through, I'll go to the same company and sign up as a new customer, maybe in my wife's name or even just do it in my own name under a different email address. And what I'm getting quoted is a lot cheaper than what I've been as a renewal. We see this all the time. And in sports memberships, golf memberships are a good one. They often have an introductory offer for the first year and they charge you the full whack after that. So loyalty is penalized and we need to be clever about that. And unfortunately, the system is designed that you might find that you need to switch providers, particularly for things like electricity and gas. You need to switch providers every year. And that's just the nature of it. And we just get used to doing that. And that's okay.
So that's what you do. You sign up or you put in for a quote under the same details except a different email address, and therefore you pose yourself as a potential new customer. That's how you've identified the differential.
It is. And sometimes I just do that and then just call them up and call them out on it. And often that can be enough for them to match the price. So it's not a case where you need to do anything that's slightly dodgy or you're uncomfortable with. It's just sometimes just pointing out that, hang on a second, you guys are actually giving the new customers a cheaper price. I tried to do it with my bin service here in Limerick, and they turned around and said, well, there's nothing we can do about that. You know, so they actually called off my bluff, which surprised me. Usually, most of the time, they will actually honour the price that you're showing on the website.
The one time I do that, well, the one time that comes to mind that I do that is if I get a price on booking.com for a hotel, and then I ring the hotel and I'd say, this is the price that I'm getting there. Do you want to give them the commission or will I book it directly through you? I'll often find as well that they will honour it. Can I ask you, what are the big humdingers that make a difference? Like, is it switching your mortgage, for example, or is it electricity and gas? During your experience of taking this Life Admin Day, what's the big win?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. Like, switching your mortgage is a much bigger process, right? Like, that involves solicitors and various things. So in terms of if you're time conscious, for me, electricity and gas is the easy one. That's a 10-minute job once you find your new supplier. Some of the other ones, internet can be a good one. Looking at things like Sky subscriptions can be a good one. Even calling up Sky and telling them that you're going to leave can often be enough to save you 20-30% because they don't want you to leave and they're going to give you a much better price to stay. So there's little things like that where you can add to your list. Home insurance is a great one. Again, home insurance is a funny one. You can get charged three times as much for one supplier to another. So the price difference is huge. So it actually pays for you to shop around or even just find a really good broker that can do a lot of this work for you. But it really depends. If you're time poor and you're worried about how long this is going to take, then start with some of those easier switching, the ones I mentioned. If you want to go after some of the bigger ones, then certainly mortgage is a good one.
Health insurance.
Thank you, Susan. That's exactly what I was going to say. Health insurance is another good one. It takes a little bit longer because there's so many policies to go through. But again, it can save $1,200 a year if you save €100 a month on your health insurance.
But therein lies the barrier that many people have to doing this, which is having to go through all of the different products. So, like, for example, in my own case, when I'm looking for health insurance and I want to compare and contrast, I would go to the HIA website, the Health Insurance Authority. If I'm looking for providers, particularly from financial services providers, I go to consumerhelp.ie. What are the websites or the price comparison tools that you go to? And you mentioned, obviously, going to an insurance broker as well being another one. But anything that could speed this up for us?
Yeah, certainly. Look, there's lots of good suppliers in Ireland. Bonkers comes to mind. There's various other ones, Quote Devil and so on. So I certainly go and use all of those just to get an idea of where things are at. And again, some of those home insurance and car insurance things, they can be a little bit cumbersome to enter the forms, but it doesn't take that long. And if you give yourself an hour or two, you will save a significant amount of money by doing that. And the big thing is, and the big thing to remember is this is all after-tax money that we're saving.
Right.
A case of €100 that you're saving and you're on the top tax bracket, that's really €200 that you're saving of worked income. And that's kind of how you need to sit to remind yourself. We all have, or for a lot of us, we'll have a February bank holiday coming up in 2 weeks' time. That's a new bank holiday that we didn't have up until a few years ago. That's a great opportunity on that day to give ourselves, take even half a day to get through a few things because it's a day that we didn't have previously to give ourselves the time.
And is there any particular way you map the day out? Do you start off in the morning, like with a lovely coffee and breakfast, and then you pull out all your sheets? Or is it right, you just have a list and you chronologically go through them? Any particular ways the day could be laid out?
Yeah, so I would always start from the easiest to the quickest to the longest one. And I have that list. I would start typically on the electricity supplier. I've tried to make all of my subscriptions and things come roughly at the same time. And if they're not on the exact same day, I'd have a calendar set anyway. Start with the list. I'm very list focused, right? That's how I like to operate. I try and get up early, so I'm starting the day nice and early, ideally before the kids have even woken up. And you're just looking to get through it as quickly as you can. And once you go through that list, you'll see it. If you go through your bank account statement, you'll see exactly what's going in and out. I mean, there's other things we haven't even talked about, like gym memberships and various things like that, that you can also tackle. Take the opportunity to have a look around and make sure that you're getting the best deal, you're happy with the value that you're getting. And then if you are, cross it off the list. If not, look to change and go from there.
Can I also ask about pensions? Because we are in the era now of auto-enrollment, and do you look at this to go beyond that to say, right, well, am I maximising? For example, if it is the case that you are saving that money, let's say you're saving the €100, the way you turn it into €200 in particular is put it straight into your pension, because then the tax that the government would be taking off it doesn't, because it goes in straight away. So do you also apply this to greater affairs in the household?
Absolutely. And look, I mean, myself and my wife would have a monthly financial meeting to discuss all of this stuff and make sure that we're happy where everything's going. The beautiful thing about a pension is it's set and forget if you do it the right way from day one.
What do you mean the right way?
So are you in a fund that's a low-cost index fund, ideally, that's suited for what you should be for your age, you know? Unfortunately, in Ireland, there's so much, we don't always know what we're getting when it comes to pensions. We're not always sold the best products. Financial advisors aren't always going to be recommending what's best for us based on our age. Often they're picking a product that's based on the fee that they're getting, right? So not necessarily what's best for our own interest. So we need to make sure that we have an understanding of that. But absolutely, especially auto enrollment is hugely exciting. It's a game changer for Ireland. But the big thing is, are we in the right funds and are we getting the right advice for our age? For me, when I started out, I was only 30 odd when I got my first pension, and I was put in a moderately safe, you know, conservative fund, which wasn't the right thing for me given my age. I had years ahead before I needed to hit pension age. I needed to be in a rather volatile fund that was going to give me better returns long term.
I'm struck by something you said at the beginning of our conversation about the shock you got in Ireland that loyalty isn't, or that loyalty is penalised. Is there anything else, looking at this from a Kiwi perspective, that you find different or notable about the Irish system?
Lots and lots of things. I've actually just come back from New Zealand. I'm horribly jet lagged at the moment. And it was fascinating to go back down and see. I think life in Ireland, there's a lot of things. Everything in Ireland is compared to Europe when we look at cost of living and various things that happen. And we forget that often there's other countries in the world that we should be comparing ourselves to. And New Zealand and Australia and America and Canada are probably good examples that we don't always compare ourselves to. But actually, when you look at cost of living compared to, say, New Zealand, Ireland's doing quite well. A lot of my friends in New Zealand struggle, really, really struggle, have been hit by the cost of living crisis much more than my friends have here in Ireland. So there's certainly things, the grass is not always greener, and there's certainly things in Ireland that are great. We're very blessed with things like low food prices and fairly affordable interest rates on our mortgages, which my friends in New Zealand were certainly struggling with. There's lots of differences, but the grass isn't always greener.
And both of our islands have plenty grass. That is for sure.
Yes.
I also am intrigued to hear, what do you do with the savings, or do you do anything apart from, like, I was suggesting putting it into your pension, but is there a reward mechanism that you have in place then where you think, okay, I have saved like X amount, which I'm guessing might be higher than the amount that you would have earned in that particular day in your job. What do you do with the money then, if anything?
So, our story is that we were super savers. I mean, we were saving at our peak up to 75% of our income.
What?
So, it was absolutely crazy. This is back in 2022. Our financial journey started in 2018, and we saved as much as we could over an extended period with three young children.
How do you even save anything with three young children?
It was tough. We lived fairly frugally for a while. Our lifestyle is very different today, but there was a number of years where we lived fairly frugally. And we now have enough money to retire if we wanted to. We have a number of investment properties. We have a very healthy pension pot. I still work. My wife doesn't work any longer, but we work on our own terms and quite differently. So we've seen the effects of this. And this is, people often say, oh, that €5 coffee that you're buying, it makes no difference. And, these small savings, they don't make much of a difference. But it all adds up and compounds. My mother-in-law is a great example. She used to spend €30 a week on the lottery. And it wasn't until I pointed out that she was spending €1,500 a year on the lottery that she stopped. And she said, well, hang on, I'm only spending €30 a week. Well, 30 times 50 is 1,500. So all of these changes compound over time. And we saw that from our own self. We initially started saving only 10% of our income, but we continually improved that month in, month out until we built that savings rate up.
Well, Michael, here is what I have, if I could wrap all of this up together, the six key things to take away from this is take the day, but start early. Loyalty is punished, so therefore try even going to the same provider that you have with a different email address and see what you'll get before shopping around. On this day, go from easiest to hardest to get the quick wins first. Bear in mind, everything you save, including a note to your mother-in-law, is that the €1,500 that you were saving from not putting in the lottery was €3,000 before tax. Set and forget when it comes to pensions is good only if it is set up properly in the first place. And the final thing is small amounts add up. There's a lot in there. So I think there could be many listeners taking advantage of the whole idea of a life at midday and also using those resources as well. Thanks so much indeed, Michael Horton, host of the Irish Fire podcast, for joining me today and taking stock. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And up next, why Giorgia Meloni might be an unlikely peacemaker between the US and Europe. Welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and I wanted to share a message that we got in from a listener in Melbourne, Australia, namely Vanessa Jan Cross, who said, call me late to the party, but I've just realised that the podcast Taking Stock is actually your radio show. I've just been binging on a few episodes and I love it, and it's wonderful to hear your voice in Oz. Well, Vanessa, we are delighted with every single one of you who listens to Taking Stock at home and abroad. Now, as tensions continue to rise between Donald Trump and European leaders over Greenland, Italy's Giorgia Meloni is casting herself as a bridge between the two and a potential mediator in an increasingly fragile relationship. But who is Giorgia Meloni and how has she found herself in this unique position? We're joined now by Amy Kasman, Rome correspondent with the Financial Times. Amy, I'm going to start off by looking back at how she came to politics. Giorgia Meloni, she entered politics as a teenager in 1992 in the Youth Front, which was a neo-fascist Italian social movement. And when it dissolved, she moved towards a more mainstream right, quickly rising as a prominent youth leader. As a young woman, before she became a household name right around the world, who was Giorgia Meloni?
Well, Giorgia Meloni has in fact been dedicated to politics since those years as a teenager. She has been incredibly involved with, as you rightly say, this neo-fascist youth movement, which is how she entered politics. And she was very dedicated. And as the party evolved, she evolved with it. The party slowly transformed and moved towards the mainstream. It changed its name. And she was just a standout leader who was very active, very fiery, an excellent speaker. She rose to become the national leader of the youth movement when the party that she, you know, joined Silvio Berlusconi's government. It was really Silvio Berlusconi, the media tycoon, who brought what the former Italian social movement into the political mainstream to join a kind of center-right coalition. And she was actually tapped. She became the youngest minister, minister ever in Italy. She had a stint as the minister of youth and sports at a very young age. But she, for the most part, she broke away from Silvio Berlusconi and she started her own party, and it was very much a small party and very much on the margins. But over time, in the recent years, she was an excellent, very fiery opposition speaker and leader. And as people grew more and more disillusioned with the mainstream parties, and they tried the Five Star Movement, a populist party that was started by a popular comedian named Beppe Grillo. That party, the Five Star Movement, had a stint in power for a while, but people grew disillusioned. Italians have been looking for a long time for a leader that they felt, you know, was serious and could run the country effectively. And in the last election, of course, they chose her as the kind of next new thing.
Now, if we look at groups of people in the Western world who've grown disillusioned with governments around, and there's plenty of them that we can look at, Amy, I'm interested to see that they turned to Giorgia Meloni because it wasn't just looking for a safe pair of hands to run the economy. I mean, she's a woman that believes in national pride, traditional family values, conservative youth policy. Is it that when people voted for Giorgia Meloni that they were voting for that, or they were voting against an alternative status quo?
I think it might have been a little bit of both. Giorgia Meloni was certainly not the first populist kind of leader out of nowhere to be elected in Italy. As I mentioned, they had previously experimented with the Five Star Movement, which was a popular mass movement that arose some years earlier and kind of shot up, really riding on popular anger, led by a comedian who really tapped into some kind of deep disillusionment with the political establishment. I mean, the political establishment had also changed. In the 1990s, the post-war political establishment that had governed Italy for decades after post-World War II kind of collapsed. Then you had Silvio Berlusconi, the charismatic media tycoon who kind of ran everything and kind of was the dominant figure, but actually drove the country right into a sovereign debt crisis.
And so, isn't this, though, where she, I'm trying to decide, has she stemmed that tide? Because the market seemed to think so. The credit rating agencies seem to think so. But I wonder if I lived in Milan or Rome or Pisa or Venice today, The Italian economic growth is 0.4%. That's what it was in 2025. It's expected to be below 1% for the next 2 years. So domestically, from an economic and fiscal point of view, how is she doing?
Okay, so this is where things get a little bit complicated. I think that from the perspective of maintaining fiscal discipline and ensuring that Italy has one of the biggest debt piles in the entire EU, approximately a debt to GDP ratio of approximately 137%.
So very Italy, close to what Greece was back in 2010, might I add.
Exactly. So Italy does need to be very careful, because if you, have the feeling that there's a driver in the car who's kind of speeding pretty wildly, you're going to find that your borrowing costs go way up and you're going to be in a crisis very quickly. Giorgia Meloni, I think, was acutely aware of the need to be financially responsible and ensure international markets and those holding Italy's sovereign debt that she was not going to do crazy things and drive the car, off the road. She had the example of Liz Truss, very short-lived prime ministership of Liz Truss, to remind her of just how fast things can go wrong and how even if you're, come to power, you can be driven out again if the markets are extremely unhappy. So she was very sensitive, and she and her finance minister have really won over credit rating agencies and debt holders with their display of fiscal prudence. They have cut the deficit. The difference in the borrowing costs of Italian debt from German debt, which has always been like a very closely watched indicator of like how risky is Italy, that indicator has been falling and falling, the so-called spread between the German debt and the Italian debt has narrowed to kind of the lowest in more than a decade and a half. So she's really won over the markets with her fiscal prudence. They feel that, in fact, she has proven to be a safe pair of hands who's not doing crazy things and is trying to manage the economy responsibly. And she herself has learned the lessons of other political leaders who kind of had crises, that led them, drove them from power.
But the Amy, the question is, has she won over the people? She's facing a big election next year.
Exactly. So now we come to the flip side of that. The flip side of that is, in order to please the domestic, the international investors and the credit ratings agencies, there has in fact been some kind of squeeze here. And, there's been a lot of inflation since she came to power. So, of course, not her fault, the invasion of Ukraine, a lot of inflationary pressures. Wages have definitely not kept up. There's been an erosion of purchasing power. Purchasing power today in Italy is still around 8% less than it was in 2021. So there is frustration among many sectors. There's a feeling that the cost of living is high. There's a feeling that, growth is meager. As you rightly said, growth is around 0.4-0.5%, which is really like almost, zero. So, and it's not expected to get all that much better this year or next year. Growth is expected to remain below 1%. So there is, and even within the business community, there's some kind of dissatisfaction and disappointment that although she's got a stable government, she's been in power for more than 3 years, which is a pretty long time by the standards of what used to be known as the Italian revolving door, she's not necessarily able to use that stability to bring growth enhancing reform. She's very cautious. She doesn't want to upset people. So there is a kind of a nagging discontent, and there is frustration. We've seen strikes over, not massive strikes, not to the level that we've seen in France sometimes, but at the end of last year, there were some pretty large strikes. And I mean, there is frustration among public sector workers that they haven't had raises. So yes, I mean, there is some kind of dissatisfaction.
Well, Amy, when you bring up France, I was also looking at the process that Giorgia Meloni had in passing her budget towards the end of last year and comparing that to what was going on with Emmanuel Macron and his revolving door of prime ministers that weren't lasting a year or months, but it was weeks and sometimes hours. But if we stick with the international scene, the reason that I wanted to talk to you today is that with all we're watching that has gone on in Davos and continues, of course, over the coming days, she, of anybody, seems to have the ear of the White House, and yet she also is building relationships strongly with Ursula von der Leyen and so on. And I think we, the world, think that Giorgia Meloni gets on very well with Donald Trump, and it's easy to understand why she might, given many of the things that they believe in. But she equally did well with Biden. So how has she managed to do what she has done when so many others are either failing or optically aren't achieving the same results as she is?
So I think Giorgia Meloni really does have very strong people skills. And I think that when people get in a room with her one-on-one or in small groups, they find that she always says that she is a person who can talk to anyone. She's straightforward. She engages. And I mean, even with the UK and British prime ministers, we saw that she had an excellent relationship with Rishi Sunak. They seemed to be very close. And then along came Keir Starmer, and they also seemed to get along quite well. And, you know, I think Giorgia Meloni is a person who has strong people skills. She is good in interacting with other leaders. She listens. She tries to find the common ground. I think that she is a person who really deeply believes in NATO and in the U.S.-European alliance. And I mean, at a time when other leaders are looking at Donald Trump and just thinking, you know, we cannot deal with this guy, we've just got to reduce our dependence, she is still very much minded in thinking that we must preserve this alliance. And I think she does work hard to try to keep the sides talking. She really emphasizes the importance of communication. And she is one of the leaders that was able to speak to Donald Trump after he threatened high tariffs on countries that had participated in this military recognition in Greenland. And I think she was quite direct with him. And I think that she's strong, she's tough, and she tells him what she really thinks, probably in a respectful way. It's clear that Trump is very fond of her. I mean, Trump is always a leader that has been said to respect strength and strong people and people that don't kowtow. I don't think she's necessarily confrontational with him, but I think that she is straightforward. And yeah, they seem to have some kind of chemistry, or, you know, they definitely have a warm bond. Of course, she was like a longtime Trump admirer, you know, years ago while still in the opposition. I'm sure that he's aware of that. She has historic ties with the Republican Party. And of course, now, I mean, she's the prime minister of Italy. He's the president of the U.S. And this is a relationship that she has to manage. I don't think it's so easy, but I think she is trying to manage it. And she really is committed to the idea of the importance of trying to preserve NATO, preserve the alliance, preserve the working relationship, and kind of prevent things as they were from falling apart. Now, whether she can achieve that, only time will tell.
Well, speaking of time telling, like, we've looked at her past, we've looked at her international record, both politically and with the markets, as well as domestically. The thing that I'm going to leave listeners on in with this conversation, Amy, is a quote she has, which is, "We're establishing an Italy that's completely different from the one the world knew and the one to which Italians themselves had seemed resigned." It'll be really interesting in the months and years ahead to see how that plays out. Amy Casman, Rome correspondent with the Financial Times, thanks so much indeed for joining me here on Taking Stock.
Thanks for having me.
Now, for my answer to the trivia this week, I was in a place in the past few days, which is widely accepted as the largest harbour in the world after Sydney. Where was I? Well, I was actually in Ringaskiddy in Cork. And indeed, Cork Harbour is the answer. It's the second largest harbour in the world. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast, first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Of course, we're also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks a million for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day. And already, I'm looking forward to chatting to you again next week.